I think the greatest tribute we can pay to Malcolm X is to be honest with ourselves and be honest about all the information we know about Malcolm X. Malcolm X is now being discovered by people who, when Malcolm X lived, if they saw him on one side of the street, they'd go to the other side. He loved his people. He saw no contradiction in being a pan-Africanist, a nationalist, and somewhat of a socialist all at the same time. When I say socialism, I'm not talking about what Carl, what's his name, had to say. There were sharing societies in Africa, South Pacific, and parts of Asia. Long before the first European wore a shoe or lived in a house that had a window.
This is a moment when we celebrate the name and the person of one of the great men in all our lives, Malcolm X. And there was this extraordinary man who was debating the politics by which America had enriched herself and had dominated other peoples in the world. And I listened and I was fascinated. And I guess he saw me with my jaw hanging open. He walked over and he held out his hand. He said, "My name is Malcolm, Malcolm X." That was my first meeting with Malcolm X. He had come to participate in a Muslim conference that was going on in Atlanta. My next meeting was shortly thereafter when I met him at the Atlanta mosque, and he had with him a young man whose name was Cassius Clay. He was the most fascinating person that I had ever met. No, I certainly did not teach Malcolm X. Malcolm X taught me, and he taught millions like me. He taught us what it meant to be black and to be proud and to be strong and to be powerful and to search out that to which we were entitled, no matter what the circumstances and no matter the opposition.
Way back in 1967, I was attending a writers' conference at Fisk University, and Dudley Randall and I were sitting at breakfast, and we had read in the paper that a book of salutary poems had been brought out about Kennedy. And so I said, "Dudley, why don't we bring out a book of poems about Malcolm?" And so before the conference ended, Dudley and I announced to the conference that we would be receiving poems for a book about Malcolm. "Lay him down gently, lay him down slow, and swathe him in linen and wrap him just so. Turn his young face toward Mecca's soft glow. Our fallen warrior, our brother freedom. I never met him personally, only saw him once or twice, but there was a thing about him that was sincere, decent, and nice, our brother freedom. I, for one, did not agree with all the things he said, but I defend his right to speak out without paying the price he paid, our brother freedom. Immortal, he sits in fine company now with Louverture and Sinque, with Vesey and Turner and Prosser and Patrice Lumumba and Medgar Evers. Our brother freedom. Malcolm is dead. Long live Malcolm. His spirit is swirling around now in this vital air, spurring us all on who seek freedom, who salute freedom. And we salute brother freedom."
All of us in our ways seem to have that sense of Malcolm's presence. And I was tickled when Eric Lincoln said that he could see Malcolm sitting over there impatiently waiting for him to finish talking, because all of us who were close to him know that one of the biggest things about Malcolm was his intense sense of time. He was always watching his watch. And as a matter of fact, he had a saying that whenever he met anybody, one of the first things he would notice was, did they wear a watch? And if they didn't wear a watch, he didn't have any time. He didn't say boo to them because he didn't want to waste his time. But I had now begun to sell to the Reader's Digest, which was a tough magazine to sell to. And I was extremely surprised when, after I got out of the service, the very first assignment, I went up and told them that there was this new kind of phenomenon called the Nation of Islam, or colloquially the Black Muslims. And I later learned that was the Malcolm X whom I'd come to see. And he came out, and in his very frank, direct way, he said, you are a spy sent by the white man. And so I assured him that I wasn't, that as a matter of fact, I had a letter from the white man to prove I wasn't, you know. So.
The original revolutionary nature of Malcolm implicated his own immediate circumstances and Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. At this stage, we find Fanon's warning about the, quote, pitfalls of national consciousness, unquote, prefigured in Malcolm's break with the NOI and the conceptual reorganization he had only begun when he was shot down, is Fanon's notion that, quote, there must be an idea of man, of the future of humanity, unquote. Otherwise, Fanon warns, quote, if nationalism is not made explicit, if it is not enriched and deepened by a very rapid transformation into a consciousness of social and political needs, in other words, into humanism, it leads up a blind alley, unquote.
Malcolm was not merely, quote, our manhood, but the keeper of the ancestral flames of a proactive response to human conditions. His life represents the rebirth of the extensive African-American commitments to cultural reconstruction, which are not yet concluded. Despite the various political and social contours of the past 20 years, we have not yet succeeded in wholly realizing the fundamental cultural vision of Malcolm X. This is certainly not to say that we have been asleep, because the revolutionary social ideas of Marlana Karinga are directly related to the Malcolmian project. What is necessary is the consistent and persistent dissemination of the ideas Malcolm espoused in regards to culture, essentially a, quote, pattern or the habit of seeing ourselves, hearing for ourselves, thinking for ourselves, and then we can come to an intelligent judgment for ourselves. Yes, sir.
Our fate is tied to that of Africa. From our homes here in the Americas, we ourselves and our children and our children and our grandchildren must lend whatever political, moral, and material aid we can to help raise Africa to full membership in the exclusive club of the world's great power. When I say great powers, I mean including military might. This rendition of neo-Pan-Africanism is how, I think, a 1990 version of Malcolm's Organization of Afro-American Unity might translate in its international aspect.
My brief and simple remarks are summary and focus on two points. First, our radical tradition, and second, a radical method that we can find in the life and leadership of Malcolm. My concern is rebuilding a revolutionary movement, articulating a framework that maximizes our collective strength to find a universal perspective to unite us in our ideological diversity on a level of politics, political theory and action. Can we find in Malcolm the basis for unity in 1990?
Even as early as this message to the grassroots speech given before suspension from the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X essentially saw black nationalism and international perspective. And I'll quote him briefly when he said, "He, the white man, knows that the black revolution is worldwide in scope and in nature. The black revolution is sweeping Asia, is sweeping Africa, is rearing its head in Latin America. All the revolutions that are going on in Asia and Africa today are based on what? Black nationalism. A revolutionary is a black nationalist. He wants a nation." In the same speech, Malcolm X attacked the concept of a nonviolent revolution as a phenomenon not confirmed by the facts of contemporary history.
Now, to be sure, Martin's and Malcolm's great difference in historical and social origins influenced them to choose different paths, different roads in which to fight for freedom. Yet it is important to emphasize that they were, from the beginning of their ministry, fighting for the same goal, and their methods of achieving it, though different, complemented each other.
I was moved as a young teenager, standing at the threshold of critical political consciousness, when I read the work of Malcolm X. Hearing echoes of the pain and anguish of my own dysfunctional childhood, of all that I had seen and experienced, I was taken to a new stage of consciousness. My paradigm shifted and my perspectives changed. Until I encountered his work, I had been content to hide, understanding to retreat into the sense of myself as an artist. When I was 16 and 17, I thought of myself as an artist who wasn't concerned with political matters. Malcolm's work, his life, his example, transformed my thinking and my way of life. Intimately, I understand what Betty Shabazz meant last night when she says, "I don't know where I would be at this point in my thinking if I had not met Malcolm."
Malcolm X's theory is a theory of revolutionary New African nationalism that has lighted the path for today's revolutionary progress and a revolutionary awakening of our African youth. Is the source of the reemergence of a movement which is before us today. Revolutionary emergence of the Malcolm X theory is something which has not come easy. It was not just a matter of calling a conference or having a few celebrations. It was something which begun in earnest in 1976 when Mutulu Shakur, who is in prison today, said, "We got to bring Malcolm back." Because the youth don't know him. Because those who know him have forgotten him. And because some people say he's a traitor and other ones say that he was confused. They say it's time to bring Malcolm back.
I also want to thank the organizers for providing this panel with such a provocative topic. Is black liberation and social revolution on the agenda, or is Malcolm out of date? First, the short answer. As long as Malcolm can generate the kind of intellectual and political energy that has been generated here today, Malcolm is not out of date. As long as young people look to Malcolm as a symbol of militant resistance and struggle, Malcolm is not out of date. And as long as the conditions we face as African Americans worsen day by day, week by week, and year by year, then Malcolm's passion, his absolute passion for liberation, is worthy of emulation, and it is not out of date.
There is no greater moment to discuss the significance of Malcolm X or to recognize that the resurgence in his culture, in his popularity, is not a revivalist initiative, but a call to rebuild a coherent and radical pole within our movement in order to face the impending storm with a level of confidence which says in no uncertain terms that we can win. Let me amplify this point for a moment. The rise of Malcolm as a symbol during the 80s after relative obscurity in the 70s, when, as was pointed out earlier, a lot of people forgot who he was, is both a criticism and a commentary. It's a criticism summed up in the slogan, "No sellout." Particularly among our youth, there is a search underway for a type and quality of leadership which represents an uncompromising stand against white supremacy and imperialism. It's also, by implication, a comment that despite the existence of powerful and progressive reform leaders such as Reverend Jackson, despite vibrant critics such as Minister Farrakhan, something is missing.
It is no longer possible to isolate and attack the blacks in the same old way. Today, the invisible man is white and poor, but he is there. Each economic and legal attack against the black pushes the unemployed white more and more into the line of fire. Malcolm X thoroughly understood this when he said, and I quote, "I believe that there will ultimately be a clash between the oppressed and those that do the oppressing. I believe that there will be a clash between those who want freedom, justice, and equality for everyone, and those who want to continue the system of exploitation. I believe there will be that kind of clash, but I don't think it will be based on the color of the skin." Close quotes. These are the conditions and the social motion that has sent our youth, our militants, our progressive intelligentsia, our restless workers searching for an ideology and a banner around which they can rally and take a stand. It was inevitable that they would discover Malcolm X waiting for them. His death was more than the creation of another martyr.
That process of legitimizing knowledge, that is, rendering Eurocentric and ethnocentric views of our history, our struggles, and our cultural creativity legitimate, while at the same time declaring everything we say for ourselves and about ourselves as illegitimate, that process simply had to be undermined if we were to reclaim our history, redeem ourselves, and liberate our minds. It is against that background that, as a bookseller, publisher, poet, and political activist, John LaRose became my mentor, and I discovered Malcolm X and all those who had gone before Malcolm and undoubtedly influenced him. Franz Fanon, W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Marcus Garvey, Sojourner Truth, Mary Seacole, C.L.R. James.
We join you all in celebrating the legacy of Malcolm X, a legacy of struggle which the enemies of human freedom in America and beyond have tried in vain to kill. The radical and revolutionary forces in Nigeria and West Africa wish to be counted among the new generation of fighters committed to continuing this radical tradition of struggle against imperialism and for the freedom of all oppressed peoples, nationalities, nations, and races of the world. Malcolm X, Che Guevara, Nkrumah, and others in that historical bracket taught us and emphasized over and over again the international character of imperialism. From this, they deduced the irreducible need for the struggle against imperialism to be international, and for the various national organizations engaged in this battle to be linked together in radical internationalism.
What then do we, as political activists, what then do we as trade unionists, workers and peasants and ordinary people do in organizing the fight back against oppression and repression as Malcolm would have done in his time? What is needed is for all of us, organized labor, community organizations, all potential institutions of people's power, to hammer out a people's plan for, first of all, national salvation wherever we may live. And let us extend a hand of solidarity so that we in Trinidad and Tobago can learn from you here in the United States of America and vice versa. So that we in Trinidad and Tobago working with Texaco or Amoco will shut down Texaco and Amoco's operations in Trinidad and Tobago at the same time that you shut them down here in the United States of America. This significance of populations at World Country is something we must need, we need to reflect seriously, and I think this is what Malcolm X wanted to promote. When Malcolm X came to Tanzania, I took him to meet President Nyerere on a very another historic date, because that very day China exploded her first nuclear bomb. And as we went to see Nyerere, Nyerere said, "Malcolm, for the first time today in recorded history, a non-colonial country has been able to develop weapons at par with any colonial power. This is the end of colonialism through and through." And Malcolm replied, said, "Mr. President, this is what I've been thinking all the way as I was coming from my hotel to this house." It just shows you the thinking of Malcolm, that international struggle has not limited just to one or two countries, but international struggle must be universal, literally and effectively. And this is what Malcolm had in mind, to promote internationalism of the third world. He foresaw what American policy meant and what it could mean in the event of third world population. We inside America could be organized and mobilized.